This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Middle East Studies podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Ruben Silverman, and with me today is Dr. Avner Wishnitzer, a professor in the Department of Middle Eastern and African History at Tel Aviv University. His first book, Reading Klux Alaturka, Time and Society in the Late Ottoman Empire, was published in 2015. His new book, which we'll be discussing today, is As Night Falls, 18th Century Ottoman Cities After Dark, published in 2021 by Cambridge University Press. And before we get into the book, I'd just like to ask you, Professor, if you could tell a little bit of your background, how you came to these topics of time and now darkness.
Hi. First of all, I'm very happy to be here, and thank you for inviting me. I'm very much interested in things that are not usually seen as important, or things that we tend to miss because they are transparent in a way, like time, like darkness. They are all around us, and because we grow up into them, so to speak, we don't notice them at all. In the same way, I'm interested in things like boredom or like facial hair, which is so, like, in the Middle East, it's so, it's everywhere. You tend not to notice it. But in fact, facial hair, for example, was and still is very important in defining oneself in different ways. Boredom is something that it's not one of these sensational emotions, but we all cope with it and think about it and experience it. And it might be also historical in the sense that it changes the way people perceive it and deal with it, changes from time to time, from society to society. So these kind of things are interesting to me because they are usually much more significant than we acknowledge at first glance. So I guess my interest in the dark hours is very similar in this way. We usually don't think about it when thinking about history, although there is already about three decades of histories of the night. In the history of the Middle East, there's almost no work done on these issues. And it's quite literally keeping half of human history in the dark, meaning that we know next to nothing about how nights or urban landscapes, centers were organized, how commerce, how politics and war was shaped or interacted with darkness. So I thought this is worth exploration.
Indeed, and that's something I was hoping to start us off talking about, which is over the years, I've seen some books, like you mentioned, about nighttime in Europe. I think Evening's Empire is a book I remember reading maybe a decade ago, something like this. But until I read your book, I really had not seen anything about the Ottoman Empire. So maybe if you can talk a little bit about what is the general interest in the night? And then what do you think, particularly looking at the Ottoman Empire, has to tell us differently?
So first of all, I think night, darkness, sleep has become a main focus of researchers in various disciplines of the last 10 or 15 years, maybe 20 years. And it has to do with current discussions of the present of the night and also the future of the night. We're talking about problems that have to do with light pollution. If it's the danger it presents to ecosystems, or its health hazards, or the amount of carbon emissions it involves, all of these things, the problem of stellar visibility, all of these things create a new discussion in the costs of this hyper-illumination and recognition of the importance of darkness in different levels, from health to aesthetics. And to this, we should add current discussions of sleep. The 24/7 society takes its toll. And what we see is a constant intrusion of time that used to be kind of shut off, a time of relative seclusion, a time of rest that is constantly disturbed by beeps and incoming messages and constant meddling with social networks and Netflix and all of these things. And indeed, I think one can think about this this time of the night as a frontier of capitalism, even. Like, various companies are trying to capitalize on this time, as Reed Hastings, CEO of Netflix, said explicitly in 2017, and I'm almost quoting, "Our major competition," he said, "is not with Amazon or HBO. Our major competition is against sleep. There is a large reservoir of time there," something like that. And so they, you know, the pressures we're experiencing with our daily or nightly life, rather, are not incidental. And it's not a conspiracy. It's a business plan. So I think all of these things together create a need to examine nighttime and sleep from various perspectives, including a historical one. What was the night? What was nightlife before this hyperillumination? How did societies organize? What kinds of nocturnal activity were even possible? What kind of entertainment, aesthetics, all of these things? What was the night important for? So what I'm trying to say here is that current discussions almost reverse traditional ways of looking at darkness as evil, as something that has to be dispelled, conquered, to a point that it's something that is almost, or not almost, has to be preserved. So we have now dark sky reserves, just like we quote-unquote conquered nature, not to say raped it, and now we have to keep some of it protected from our own deeds. And the same we need to do with darkness. So we have these dark sky reserves all around the world, which are pretty much the only places you can actually experience deep darkness today. So out of this understanding that darkness and night has significance. It's not just the lack of something. It's not the lack of light. It's not the lack of wakefulness. It is an entity in its own right with its own impact on humans and non-humans alike. This is where I started from. Now, what did it mean for past societies? Now, as for the Ottoman case, I think it's a particularly interesting case because whereas histories of the night in early modern Europe mostly advance along an axis of gradual illumination, that also has to do with enlightenment in terms of, you know, the project of enlightenment, but I'll put that aside for a second. Actual illumination, street lighting, increasing amounts of light in indoors and outdoors. In the Ottoman Empire, we do not see a parallel process. So you have, on the one hand, some of the processes we see in Western Central Europe, such as urbanization, the branching of the expansion of state apparatus, and the rise of a new urban culture, and so on and so forth. But it all happens in the dark, so to speak. So this opens a range of questions that do not present themselves when you're working on Western Europe or North America. We have very little work done on anywhere outside of these areas, which in itself is a problem. So this is, you know, why I think it's worthwhile.
Indeed. So, well, the way you organize the first half of the book, we can say, is you move from households out to the larger society. So I thought we could follow that trajectory too. And maybe you can talk a little bit about households and how night was experienced in different types of households. So there's depending how gender comes into play, how class, like smaller households versus the royal household. Households in these different regards would be fascinating to hear a little bit about.
So in general, one of the things that I tried to do in the first chapters is to outline kind of the way or the rhythm of twilight, basically, and to, you know, accompany households as they go to sleep, basically, and to try and learn when this happens and how this happens. So my focus is on Istanbul and Jerusalem. It should be mentioned. Like, these are the two case studies. And the reason I picked these cities is because they are so different. One is a port city, a major metropolitan with a very diverse population, different languages. And the other is a walled city off the mountain, away from the sea, more homogeneous, much smaller. We're talking about maybe 8,000 people, maybe 10,000 people during the 18th century. And by this, I want to say that there is a whole range or spectrum of possible nocturnal realities in the Ottoman Empire during this time. And we're not even talking about the vast majority of people who lived in the villages, in rural areas. And we already know that for them too, there was, you know, things went on into the dark to some extent, but my book doesn't cover it. This requires a whole other research. So even within the urban centers, of course, there were differences between along the lines of class and gender and so on. So I would say in the residential neighborhoods in Istanbul, twilight would be, the time generally between the evening prayer and the night prayer would be twilight, not only in natural terms and as regards the dwindling light, but also in social terms. It is in between phases. And even Jewists, they discuss whether this time is part of the day or part of the night or, part of its own. So for women and children, the evening prayer is a border not to be crossed. This was true for contemporary Europe as well. Women outside after dark risk their reputation. But for men, this is still, this is probably the most profitable time of coffee houses and taverns. It goes on until the night prayer, which is really the beginning of the actual night. This is when lights in the mosque would be shut down and the night watch would go on patrol and people would make their way home. This happens between, let's say, something like 7:15 in our terms, meantime terms, between 7:15 and something like 10:40 p.m. Mm-hmm. At the height of summer. So it changes with the season, of course. People would go to sleep, most people, okay, most people, and I'll refer to that in a second, would go to sleep around that time, around the time of the evening, of the night prayer, or slightly thereafter. How do I know this? I know this from narrative sources, but I also know this from a more or less systematic quantitative analysis of 146 cases that were brought to the Üsküdar court, which report cases that happened at night, be them quarrels or brawls or thefts or anything that happened after sunset. And when you check the time as it is reported, you find very little cases, very few cases that happened after the night prayer. This does not mean that there was nothing going on, but rather that even when we are talking about the dark hours, most of the activity was concentrated between the evening prayer and the night prayer. Then one of the main reasons for this, I think, is that light was quite expensive. Mm. So one of the chapters focuses on artificial light, and I show that for an unskilled construction worker to get several hours of light would mean working quite a bit. And when I compare it to London, for example, you see that light is more accessible in London than it is in Istanbul. And it's more accessible in Istanbul in the early 18th century than it is in the early 19th century. So these trends work to discourage nocturnal entertainment or life of any kind, because in the total darkness of the 18th century, there's very little you can do without candles or lanterns or artificial lighting. Who has access? Of course, the elite. And indeed, I show that in the palace, they were able to prolong their activity deeper into the night, up until something like 2 and sometimes 3 hours after most of the people turned in. Mm-hmm. So you see that the difference in differential access to life translates into differential nocturnal conviviality or entertainment. Mm. or ability to still do things at night. And this, again, is similar to contemporary Europe, where you also see this gap between the sleeping time of commoners and elites. But in Europe, during the same time, what we call sometimes nocturnalization, that is the use of the night for activity, goes much deeper. So elites would spend time together doing things, socializing much deeper into the night than was customary among elites in Istanbul.
Hmm. Well, so this brings me to a different question. I want to get into the type of socialization that did happen at night in a second, but in the world outside the house, the world of the street, the nighttime world, what sort of activity did predominate? Who exercised control? Who was active? And this brings to a wide cast of individuals you talk about, from janissaries to Kulhan Beys to all sorts of different groups. And I'm wondering if you give some sense of this on the streets at night. What is happening then?
Right. So basically, the authorities are trying to minimize traffic at night by using different methods, including gating and all kinds of barriers, but also imposing the obligation of each individual to carry a lantern, which also means imposing costs on people who want to be outside after dark. And the possibility of getting caught is also the possibility of losing face, because if you were outside after dark without a lantern, that means you are up to no good. And there were different practices of shaming that I write about, which usually means what I call bringing to light, which mean exposing those who try to wrap themselves in darkness, exposing them in the eyes of the community. Nevertheless, people did go outside seeking different things. So first of all, we have the people who are making a living after dark. And the night opened possibilities of livelihood that they could not offer. And these possibilities were mostly taken by people who had no other choices. And it still is the case that night jobs are usually not something that people choose to do. They are forced to do still today. And this was the case in 18th century Istanbul. So we have fishermen that are practicing different types of nocturnal fishing. You have hammam stokers. You have people that are processing meat to get the meat ready by the morning prayer. You have guards of different types, neighborhood guards and, people on patrol. You have a vast sector of what we would call male-oriented entertainment, which means drinking, gambling, and commercial sex. And I show that we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of taverns. Most of them are unauthorized. And around them sometimes brothels, and sometimes it's the same place, and so on. So you have a rather large population that is drawing its livelihood in the dark. Of course, you can mention crime and smuggling of all types among these people. And most of these people, again, are of modest socioeconomic background. They take these jobs because they need the money and because they cannot afford to care about the stigma, the negative values that are associated with some of these professions. Then you have the people that use the night for contemplation, Sufi or Orthodox, turning to God, and there's a lot of writing, in particular among Sufis, about the benefits of staying up awake, and I use poetry, Sufi poetry, to show how they treated the night, how they perceived it positively as the best time to reach union with God, but also the torment that these practices of denying oneself sleep were involved in. And then finally, you had the people who were seeking entertainment. I mentioned them before from the other side, of those who offer this entertainment and make a living. But you have definitely thousands and thousands of people, according to the numbers of institutions or establishments that sell these services, like alcohol. We can tell that the numbers of that the clientele was vast, and these people too. Darkness is particularly important for them, because if we're talking about Jews and Christians who are allowed to drink, fine, they can be seen drinking, no problem. But for and Muslims who don't particularly care about their reputation, if they're dervishes or what have you, lower class, migrants to the cities, and so on. But you have apparently a rather large population of people who, Muslims, who seek, who want to drink, but don't want to be seen drinking. And then, so you have this out of sight scene that is huge, and it goes on for decades and decades. And everybody know it's there. So it's not that darkness hides this scene from communities or from the authorities, but rather that it allows everybody to turn a blind eye, to act as if it didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And people do mind. I mean, some people mind, but the state has... Not the state as a monolith, but different officials have vested interest in this scene because they draw tax money and penalties that are inflicted on people who are caught drunk in the streets, and of course bribes money. So from the highest authorities that officially draw the tax money that is levied on the taverns, to the janissary on patrol who can draw a bribe for keeping a tavern open when the time has come to close it. So many different people have an interest in keeping this scene alive. And indeed, it remains very wide. And every once in a while, there comes a sultan that says, okay, we need to shut this down. But usually... It takes very short time for this to reopen. So one last thing that I would say about the creatures of the Ottomanite is that it was dangerous outside because of the limited surveillance capabilities of both communities and the authorities. And so those who did go outside were either those who had to, because they had no other choice, they had to make a living, or those who could, rely on themselves or on on others to protect themselves. So, for example, young men, especially Janissaries that I tried to show, were particularly friendly with darkness. They could rely on their arms and their solidarity, their friends, to protect themselves. But for people who are weaker, night was certainly dangerous. And as I said, for women, it was a time to be in. So it's important because it warns us against imagining early modern night as a kind of haven that everybody can find refuge in from the oppressive diurnal order. It was that for some people, but for some others, it was certainly not a time of freedom.
Fascinating. So this brings me to, I guess, the more the political economy of the nighttime. Where is the light coming from? How is it produced? How is it distributed? Who gets it and why? How does this, you call it the Ottoman lighting system. How does this work?
Right. So basically, it's not very different from other commodities that are provisioned to Istanbul, from flour to sheep, but it has its own uniqueness in some ways. So basically, light in Istanbul, as opposed to Jerusalem and other places, is made usually from either tallow or beeswax. Tallow is usually in the Ottoman Empire produced from sheep. In Europe, it's very often from cows or other things. But in the Ottoman Empire, it is drawn from sheep that are brought to Istanbul in the hundreds of thousands and slaughtered in the slaughterhouses around the city. And the candle producing guilds were subject to the guild of the butchers, because they drew the raw material from the butchers, and they would get tallows, and there was a whole system of deciding what candle makers get, what share of the tallow that is produced in Yedikule or in Eyup or so on. And there were many, many different conflicts about getting this the tallow, because some butchers found ways to sell it on the black market, and then the candle makers would not get their share, and they would be without the raw material they need to make candles with. So, but at least in theory, they were supposed to get the tallow and the linen for the week and produce the candles. These candles were, the tallow candles were very dim, smelly, and they took constant maintenance to just simply to burn. If you didn't trim the wick as often as every 15 minutes or so, it would gutter and you would lose much of the burning material, and it would emit even more smoke and even more bad smell. So keeping candles alive would take a lot of, especially when you have more than one, and one was, I mean, you couldn't do anything with just one tallow candle. You need quite a few to even do the most basic things, never mind reading or anything like that. Then you had beeswax, which was much lighter. The light it produced was lighter, and it didn't produce this bad odor, and it took less maintenance. And so elites had access to beeswax, which was much more expensive, as much as three times as much as tallow candles. So it was centrally organized, the provisioning of the raw material. So, you know, the government was concerned about scarcities, and if all the tallow arriving to the city from the outside was supposed to go to the central depot, and if they sensed that there is a danger of scarcity, they would try to, you know, get governors to send in more tallow or more sheep from the provinces. And it had a curve that was, you know, connected to the life cycle of the sheep, because the sheep would usually, they would have the young ones in the spring, and only after that would sheep be marched on foot from, say, the Danube provinces to Istanbul. And then in the summer, they would be kept around Istanbul to fatten after the long march, and then brought into the slaughterhouses. So in the autumn, you would have enough meat and tallow. But by the end of winter, very often you got scarcities. You know, there wasn't enough tallow, there weren't enough candles, and people complained and sometimes even rioted because there was no candle in to buy. So the government was concerned about it, not only on the on the part of provisioning it, but also about distributing it, making sure that, okay, the palace got, or the palaces of the royal family got their share, and then mosques, very important, because light was used to mark specific days and to allow prayers to go on and to exhibit sultanic power at night. But also ordinary people, as I said, they were concerned that, you know, this was considered a basic necessity. And when people didn't get their candles, they didn't like it, and they sometimes voiced their concerns. So that this system of distribution was supposed to make sure that everybody got their share. But of course, commoners got less light and of poor quality. And the gap was quite significant. I tried to show how much it, you know, the costs of these things, and you see the immediate impact it has on one's ability to prolong his or her activity into the dark hours. If you don't have, or if light is so expensive, you know, there's not much you can do, even inside.
Now, the final but big question I want us to kind of work our way through is, you've chosen the 18th century to look at, the 1700s. What does the use, does the symbolism, does the politics of light change during this 100, 120, 130 year period? And if so, how do you see it changing?
Sure. So indeed, the final part of the book is more about politics and the way night and light at night is used by hegemonic actors, especially the palace, and counter-hegemonic actors, especially the Janissaries, from the late, late 18th century, all the way down to 1826. And yes, I think there is a change in the way the palace uses light to demonstrate power, and this has to do with early, you know, the attempts or the effort the court puts into reclaim its position in Istanbul following, you know, the Edirne episode. And the palace does this in many, many different ways, as different historians have already demonstrated since the early 18th century, and maybe especially during the so-called Tulip era, but maybe, you know, there's a whole discussion going on about this periodization. But what I try to show is that when it comes to nighttime, power was demonstrated through light. The ability to amass huge amounts of candles and lamps was an expression of power. Either the Sultan or you know, members of the elite sought to demonstrate their power by staging demonstrations of light or light spectacles. And again, this is very similar to contemporary Europe, where you would have very similar light spectacles. And the Ottomans would certainly invite European envoys to witness their light spectacles, which included not only thousands of lights and mirrors and bottles of you know, water in different colors that created a kind of a game of light and reflections, but also fireworks. And these could be private or semi-private occasions, or this could be part of a public festival. But in all of these events, light was explicitly linked to power. And by explicitly, I mean that texts that were written for and about these events made the connection very explicit. In poetry, in chronicles, in surnames, that is, you know, festival albums, and European envoys really very easily understood, you know, the politics of it, because it was very much the same in Europe. And at least one Ottoman was invited to witness such a festival in France when he was there. This is Mr. Kizcelebi in the early 1720s. Mm-hmm. So the palace is, especially the palace, is putting large amount of money into these light spectacles, also into lighting up mosques and festivals that have to do with the royal dynasty. So it's really quite literally projecting power stressing the link between dynasty and Islam and religion, you know, din and devlet, in particular ways. For example, by lighting up mahya inscriptions made of lanterns that highlighted these connections. These inscriptions would be hung between turrets of the minarets of mosques, of imperial mosques, or with such messages. So yes, we do see a way of using real light in this way, but also metaphoric light. So the writing about the dynasty increasingly identifies the monarch with light and its enemies with darkness. Now, this is, of course, an age-old technique, rhetorical device. But what we see, I think, in the as the century progresses, is that increasingly the Janissaries are associated with darkness. And by so doing, writers that are associated with the palace turn what is, in the end of the day, a political, social political struggle into a kind of a moral struggle that of good against evil. And of course, once you frame a struggle in these terms, the consequences that it should end by the you know, total defeat of darkness. There's no way you can compromise with when you're using such dichotomic terms. And I think metaphoric light and metaphoric darkness are increasingly used to frame the growing tension between the palace and Janissaries in the late 18th century, early 19th century. So it is a game that is played not only in the material world, but also in discourse, with interesting interactions between the two, between those two layers or aspects.
One thing I particularly like about the book is the way you draw on just such different types of sources. So you have the economic data to talk about production distribution. You have court records to look at how policing is done. And you also bring in so much poetry, and you analyze and use it as examples. What drew you to poetry as a way of coming at some of these topics? I'm just curious.
So my love affair with Ottoman poetry, and it's a good opportunity to mention Walter Andrews, because it began with studying with Walter Andrews at the University of Washington in Seattle. The late Walter Andrews, whom I miss a lot, and I'm not the only one. So I got there when I was working on my first book, and Walter kind of opened this whole world of Ottoman poetry about which I knew nothing. And then Selim Kourou also, they kind of showed me the way, and this huge corpus of texts that that over centuries was so important in Ottoman social life, and not just among the elites, as we once used to think. And not only as I don't use it only as a window onto the past, so to speak, but understanding that this poetry was so important, you ask how it was used by contemporaries to mediate, to understand, to muse about, to think about, to frame different aspects, in this case, of the night. I realize there's so much poetry on nighttime. I just scratched the surface. And the similes that I used in this poetry have to do with so much of the nocturnal experience that some of it is no longer available to us. For example, the stars. Anyone who's read even one couplet knows that the stars figure so prominently in this poetry. But if you look at the sky tonight, you know, from wherever you you are at, you won't be able to see the stars. But for them, it was just, you know, they raise their eyes and they see, you know, this incredible nightly sky, or the dew, or the, you know, the evening wind, or what have you. It was really a bodily feeling that you have to understand in order to understand some of this poetry. So I just thought that it was a natural go-to corpus, but certainly it cannot stand alone because of the, you know, specific problems that this source, like any other source, presents. I don't think it's any better or any worse than working with, I don't know, court records or chronicles or surnames or ruznames or whatever. And each and every one of these sources present its own complications, and you need to figure out how. I mean, these are not mines of facts that you can just go in and dig. You have to understand how each of these sources or the traditions organize the texts. I mean, these are basic, you know, understandings for any historian. But I enjoyed working with it, although it's not always easy.
No, I imagine, given my limited Ottoman language abilities, I can do nothing but just be impressed. So very nice. Let me wrap this up by asking, you mentioned beards, you've mentioned boredom. Are these topics that you're now looking into for, say, your next book, or are you looking at other things?
Boredom and facial hair are things that I've already published on, articles rather than books. But no, right now I'm looking at the history of imagination. Can imagination be historicized, and what it means to approach Ottoman imagination as a historian, because there are, you know, discussions of imagination in different disciplines, but there's almost no historical discussions of imagination anywhere in the world. I'm starting to think about how societies construct, limit, shape the imagination of individuals, what protocols are used, and this has to do with work that has been recently done in history of cognition, history of emotions, things like that. So this is what I'm looking at these days, but this is really just the beginning.
It certainly sounds like an interesting new field of inquiry. I look forward to it. Well, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today. It's really much appreciated, and the book is wonderful. So I hope people listening will go out and read it, because we only scratched the surface of all the interesting examples, anecdotes, details that are contained within it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.